From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The new legislative session convenes next week, and the Cape Fear region has priorities. This is the time municipalities solidify and communicate that their agenda to their local delegation. Today, we're going to hear from four people representing North Carolina, southeastern North Carolina, and we're going to do this in two separate segments. Near the bottom of the hour, in the second segment, we'll meet freshman Senator Harper Peterson, the Democrat who edged out then-incumbent Michael Lee in the November election for Senate District 9. Also joining us in the second segment, Republican Representative Holly Grange of District 20. But first, we're going to talk with Democratic Representative Deb Butler, who just won her bid for re-election in District 18, which includes parts of New Hanover and Brunswick County. She is also a newly elected Democratic whip, and so begins her first full term, even though it's your second term. Representative Butler, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel.
Also with us now, Republican Representative Ted Davis Jr., who starts his fourth term in the District 19 seat representing New Hanover County. Representative Davis, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Rachel.
And now we're inviting you to join the conversation as we start 2019 and the next class of legislators heads to Raleigh. What would you like to see them take along as part of their marching orders? You can weigh in on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Representative Butler, I can't really move forward without acknowledging the profound loss that you suffered last month, the sudden death of your spouse, Annie. And I know that I'm not alone in offering heartfelt condolences for this tremendous and unexpected loss.
Yeah, thanks very much, Rachel. It's certainly a trying time for me personally, but I have to just, and this is a wonderful opportunity for me to thank this community. The outpouring of support that I have felt personally is awe-inspiring, and I'm so thankful to be a part of this community, and so I thank you for addressing it so that I could thank the people who have been so supportive. It's impossible to do individually, I think. So thank you for the opportunity.
And you had to do some kind of calculus about whether you were going to move forward with your representative duties in Raleigh. How did you finally decide that this was something you needed to do?
Yeah, I think for about a nanosecond, I wondered if it was the right thing for me to do. But pretty quickly in my ear, I could hear Annie saying, "You mean I've done all this work to get you to this place and to support you and to lift you up?" And she was eternally proud of my representation and was so stalwart in her generosity that to do otherwise would be disgracing her memory, and that I just could not do. So I'm ready, and I might be a little bit weary from time to time, but it's very important to me, so I'm going to continue to do the people's work.
And I think everybody understands that, and we thank you for doing that. Representative Ted Davis, you're launching your fourth term, but there are a lot of people who sort of vaguely understand the way the legislature works in Raleigh, but have no idea what it's like to actually go there. And I remember you talking with me at one point after you were a freshman and some of the things that surprised you about that experience and what a day is like, and it's just not what you think. So if you could pull back the curtain for our listeners a little bit, what after the election, what happens next?
As far as a legislative day, the one word I can use to describe it is intense. When you go in, committee meetings start in the morning, and you have people that want to come see you. Some make appointments, some just drop by. Lobbyists, same way, want to come talk to you about bills that might be coming up or different topics. Some have appointments, some don't. We do get a break for lunch. And what you do, what I normally do is go down to the legislative cafeteria where my fellow representatives are, and we talk business the whole time. which is good because you get to see a lot of people that you don't ordinarily get to see, and you can talk about bills that you may have that you want them to support or vice versa. And then sessions usually in the afternoon, and you go to that. Then after sessions, you may have more committee meetings or you may have more appointments. And then sometimes at night, you'll have an event to go to. I don't do a whole lot of that. I'm so worn out by the end of the day. I just like to go back to where I stay and chill out, try to go to bed early and get up the next day and do it all over again.
And what day do you usually drive up during the week?
Session is on Monday night. Normally it starts at 7. The Republicans caucus at about 5:30 or 6. I'm sure the Democrats do the same. And very rarely would you have a committee meeting on Monday afternoon. But you do that. We try to get through no later than 10 o'clock so everybody can get home. Earlier, the better. And then Thursdays, the speaker usually tries to wrap up so everyone can leave to go home, which I like to leave before 3 so I can get home before dark.
Representative Butler, one of the things that also just happened for you, you were elected Democratic whip. Again, some people might be vaguely tuned into what that really means and the function of a whip, but explain it and explain it in the context of this legislature.
Well, a Democratic whip or a whip of any party is someone who is part of the leadership team. We have our minority leader, Representative Darren Jackson. He is the general. He has an assistant or a deputy leader who's Robert Reeves. And then we have our whips who are part of the leadership team. So it's about communication. I am responsible for communicating with approximately 1/4 of our Democratic caucus. And my job is to communicate with them, to make sure that they understand the bills that are before them, to identify how they think they plan to vote. And I'm sort of, I guess you'd call me one of the, it's almost like the Army, organized like the Army. And so my job is to be maybe a colonel, not the general, but I'm maybe a lieutenant colonel or something like that, to try to manage part of the caucus and make sure that everyone is informed and voting the way we want them to vote.
At what point do you expect to learn about committee assignments, Representative Davis?
That's an excellent question. The non-standing committees have been announced, and I'm on the same ones I was previously. The standing and special committees have not been announced yet, and with session starting next week, I hope that'll be done pretty quickly.
And would that include the North Carolina River Water Quality Committee?
Yes, that was a select committee. So that they have yet to be named. But I will say that committee expired at the end of the year, and I've already spoken to Speaker Tim Moore about let's keep it going because it is so important. This is a problem that's not going to go away, and he is very in favor of doing that.
You're listening to Coastline. The North Carolina General Assembly convenes next week, and today we're hearing from 4 local legislators about their agendas for the coming session. With us in this segment, Representative Deb Butler, Democratic Whip from District 18, and Representative Ted Davis Jr., Republican from District 19. You can ask your own question or weigh in on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Don writes, assuming the recent North Carolina amendment to require voter IDs, photo IDs, to make elections legitimate and fair, wouldn't this be a good time to advance that purpose by having the voting districts drawn up by independent and unbiased processes and entities? I.e., he says, eliminate gerrymandering. Excellent question. Is there going to be an appetite for a nonpartisan process? Representative Butler.
I certainly hope so. I really believe that gerrymandering is at the root of the partisan bickering we find in Raleigh and nationally. You know, because when the districts are drawn and legislators are choosing their voters, you can pretty well imagine that those on the left, Democrats, have to take a hard step to the left, and my Republican colleagues have to take a hard step to the right. And I think it creates a divide that's not necessary. We all need to come back to the middle. And I think independent, the League of Women Voters has come up with a very, working formula to do just that, so that an independent commission can do that. And I know that Representative Davis might have a differing opinion, but, you know, we can always have legislative approval. You know, so there can be a compromise that independent districts can be drawn with a legislative approval component that might satisfy everybody. I think it's long overdue, honestly.
Representative Davis, will there ever be an appetite for that in the majority? When you're in the majority, you don't need to compromise, right? I mean, what's your incentive to look for the right thing and the nonpartisan answer?
It's been interesting to see that the people that want the independent selection are usually the party that's in the minority, and that makes sense. I don't normally sign pledges, but I did last session to support the creation of an independent board to look at doing the districts. I cannot tell you whether there's going to be an appetite to do it or not. I know it's something that's definitely on the drawing board, and I know it's something that will be addressed. How far it goes, I do not know. My biggest problem will be, although I support the concept, will be coming up with a procedure that can be truly nonpartisan. To me, that is a very difficult thing to do. I've reviewed what's been done in other states that might be a guide for North Carolina to use, but if we can come up with a truly nonpartisan group that can select the districts, then I've already stated that I would be in favor of it.
Well, that is good news for me to hear, and I'm very encouraged because I think you have evolved on that, and I appreciate it. I'm very glad to hear him say that because, honestly, if you're in the minority today, you might very well not be in the next session. So, again, with a more visionary approach, we should all be able to embrace it.
Exactly. And, you know, when the flip was true, when Democrats had the majority, there was also plenty of gerrymandering that went on in that case. Alan writes, please, please, please base your decisions on wisdom, compassion, and a strong sense of humanism. Alan says, I understand agreeing to disagree is part and parcel of the legislative process, but I urge you to work endlessly to find common ground that benefits North Carolina citizens. There seems to be a theme running through what is on our listeners' minds right now, Representative Davis. Do you think that constituents are finally reaching the point where they're going to demand more, less division, more compromise, more negotiation from their legislators?
I would like to have less division and more compromise in the legislature. One of the biggest things that disappoints me, and it's not only in Raleigh, it's nationally and locally, is the lack of civility. People can agree to disagree. I mean, I can go to Raleigh and Representative Butler and I can have 180-degree opposite supporting of a particular issue or not supporting a particular issue, and we can have dialogue, but it can be done respectfully. I see so much up there that is not done that way, and a lot of childish bickering. I am hoping and anticipate that the fact that the Republicans have lost their veto-proof majority in both the Senate and the House will help the Republicans not do so much of some of the stuff that we've been doing that I don't necessarily agree to, and hopefully that the governor and the Senate and the House can work together, and let's try to do what we're up there, and that's to try to work for what's best for the people that we represent and the state of North Carolina. So I am openly optimistic. When you look at a glass of water, I see half full, not half empty. I'm an optimistic guy. I try to think positive. So I'm going into this hoping that we can all work together and make great things happen for this state because we are on a great roll right now. I want to keep going that way.
You're listening to Coastline. The North Carolina General Assembly convenes next week, and we're hearing from local legislators about their agendas for the coming session. With us right now, Representative Ted Davis Jr., Republican of District 19, and Representative Deb Butler, Democratic Whip from District 18. You can ask your own question or weigh in on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Brian from Wilmington called in and asked, why the legislative body curtailed the powers of the governor last session. And I guess that would be an answer for you, Representative Davis.
Certainly. And that's one of the things that I think is unfortunate in the fact that after Governor Cooper was elected, it seemed that the Republicans right off the get-go wanted to do things to try to usurp his power or take power away. I am hoping, and the thing that results from that, Rachel, which really is disruptive to the legislative process and what we're up there for, what I believe we're up there to do, and that is look at all the court cases that have been filed. It seems like you can't even sneeze up there without somebody suing somebody else. And that, to me, is counterproductive. So I'm really hoping that all these battles that we're having can just be resolved, and let's just move forward.
The federal government shutdown is actually now affecting North Carolina's ability to monitor Gen X levels in the Cape Fear River. That news came last week. According to the Star News, the EPA lab in Georgia that takes those water samples and analyzes them. I don't know if it's open or not, but it's not analyzing samples since it's federally funded. So we're looking at EPA, which I think some folks at the state level have had a hard time understanding why there hasn't been more guidance on dealing with compounds or regulating compounds like Gen X and other PFAs in the waters and PFOAs. What does this tell us about what the federal government is going to do to protect the water supply? And does this kind of add to the urgency, Representative Butler, for bringing state standards perhaps into a little more stringent range, which I know is anathema. And Representative Davis, I'll get you to respond to that as well. But
well, one thing, Rachel, and I would hope that Representative Davis could get behind this. You know, until we repeal the Hardison Amendment in North Carolina, we are hamstrung and have to constrain our regulations to comport with the federal regulations.
But I understood with
nothing
the Hardison,
more stringent.
Right. But with the Hardison Amendment, isn't there also a loophole so that if there's a serious public safety issue or some kind of situation that's deemed an emergency, you can make an exception?
Well, I would certainly hope so. But I think we're going to probably be splitting hairs on defining an emergency. I think it's been an emergency. We didn't know that for the last 30 years, but it's an emergency now. I would like to see the Hardison Amendment repealed so that North Carolina is in charge of the regulatory framework that we use. I think we need to have more stringent regulations because, honestly, when you understand that there are 85,000 chemicals used in manufacturing in this country, and we only have standards for a scant handful, I mean, literally maybe 20 of those, it should terrify us. We are doing, the collaboratory is doing good work that was, given some resources to do some work. They're studying how to analyze these compounds. It's very hard to know the needle in the haystack you're looking for when you don't know what the needle is. So they're doing some incredible science, is my understanding, to try to determine those things, and we'll see. But I think we've got an incredible amount of work to do, and we can be national leaders on emerging compounds if we apply ourselves. And I think that with robust funding of DEQ, which I would suggest is not at the level it should be, working in tandem with our academic, framework, we can be leaders. But we have to all work together to do it.
Representative Davis.
For those that might not know, the Hardison Act states that a state cannot impose a regulation more harsh than the federal regulation. One thing that I don't understand from reading that newspaper article the other day is that I took part in a bill that later led to an appropriation to give money to DEQ, which included a spectrometer to help them monitor the chemicals. What that appropriation also did and the legislation did is it transferred, if you will, the responsibility for going out and trying to find the emerging compounds in the water over to the collaboratory, which is associated with the University of North Carolina system. It also encompasses NC State, Duke University, private as well as public schools, chemists, equipment, spectrometers, everything that is needed to actually go out and find these particular components. And it just bothered me why DEQ I can understand why the samples are being sent to the lab, I believe it's in Atlanta, that is federally funded, cannot do the work, but yet you've got all this collaboratory over here that has the knowledge, the expertise, and the equipment to do this. And why they are not using that, I really don't understand. But I hope that they will, because one of the things, as I remember, in discussing that legislation and having the collaborator was involved, was to have a system intact in case the federal government was to stop doing what they're doing and the testing. Also, you have a long waiting period when the samples are sent to Atlanta until they get back, and the collaborator could provide a quicker analysis for us. So I just hope, like Deb was saying, that we can all work together and let's move forward, because like I said earlier, this problem is not going
to
go away.
And so we don't have an answer then as to why analysis of samples would have stopped from a functional point of view.
Well,
you're saying we have the resources, both human and machine, to do it.
But that's here through the collaboratory. What you're referring to was the federal government down in Atlanta. Well, if they're not going to do it for whatever reason, then my suggestion is, why don't we use the facilities we have with the collaboratory and the expertise we have with them?
Well, my understanding is that we are using the collaboratory resources now. But the problem with that, they are a great resource, but they don't have any regulatory authority, Rachel, to stop polluters. And so what's going to happen is the collaboratory is going to do this testing, and then they're going to notify DEQ. And they're going to say, hey, we found a spike over here in Cumberland County. We found a spike over here in Lenoir County. And then the Department of Environmental Quality is going to then have to go back and retest, because you have a chain of evidence problem. The collaboratory people are scientists. They are not policemen. They don't have the regulatory authority to stop polluters. So while it is a resource, we still have to have a robustly funded Department of Environmental Quality who can stop polluters, make them pay for the damage they do to our environment. So those two have to work very closely to get the job done. And underfunding DEQ is a big problem.
If I could touch on that, because everything that's being said isn't quite correct. The collaboratory, once again, through this legislation and funding, was given the task of going out and finding these components. DEQ is the regulatory agency. That is their main job, and they are still the regulatory agency. So, yes, they have to work together. No, I don't agree that when the collaboratory finds something, DEQ's got to go out and reanalyze it all over again. And I will say, as far as underfunding DEQ, that legislation did give DEQ over $5 million to help them, which included a spectrometer that they wanted as far as monitoring. It was not the spectrometer that they originally wanted, which would have helped them find the things, because we were giving that over to the collaboratory. But it also included $250,000 recurring funds so they can hire back the people that they say that they need to increase their staff. So things have been done, maybe not as much as people want, but we did make positive steps to provide funding to DEQ.
And we have Mac from Wilmington. Mac, you wanted to ask a question about industrial poisoning of resources. You're on the air.
Thank you. This is Mac from Wilmington, and my question was, really about what initiatives they were going to enact in this session to deal with this industrial poisoning. But I'd like to push back a little bit on what they're saying. I mean, this rises to the level of crime. They were engaged in their equipment up there pumps this material into the river, and people down here died because of that. We need to have a criminal complaint filed so we can have the power of the court for discovery. Their information at the company, they have the information about the effects of this stuff, and this has been borne out in previous lawsuits where they continuously prevaricated until they were forced to reveal their internal documents.
Okay.
That's what we need here.
Well, let's put this to our legislators. We're running out of time here. Representative Butler, is a criminal complaint part of the ultimate end game?
I would not be surprised to see class action lawsuits ensue. And people are perfectly entitled to use the legal system to defend themselves in any way, shape, or form. There is a consent order that's been signed in existing civil litigation, and that is a very long conversation, perhaps for another day. But
that's
a lot
its
of
own topic.
Yes, yeah. It is. But a lot of that pollution, great strides forward have been made. Not enough. We're not anywhere near where we need to be, but we have penalties have been levied, and you know, most of that current contamination is going to, you're going to see it greatly reduced within the next year.
And that's our time. Thank you so much for being with us, Representative Butler, Representative Davis. Appreciate your time. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from Representative Holly Grange and Senator Harper Peterson. It's a look ahead at what is likely to come out of the year's long session in Raleigh for the Cape Fear region. If you'd like to ask your own question, call us on this Wednesday, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's an exploration of legislative agendas, specifically what people in the Cape Fear region hope their legislators will do in Raleigh. The General Assembly convenes for the long session next week. Joining me now, Representative Holly Grange, Republican from House District 20. Representative Grange, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. And Senator Harper Peterson, Democrat in District 9, who is heading to Raleigh as a legislator for the first time. Senator Peterson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to ask your own question on this Wednesday, you can do that by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. According to the City of Wilmington's legislative agenda, bridging the urban and rural divide without sales tax redistribution is at the top. This, we hear, is likely to come up again, and your constituents, this region, would stand to lose, not gain, if sales tax revenue is adjusted to give more to rural counties. What's your case against it, Representative Grange?
Well, we are a growing area, and to me, it's not fair that we would have to forfeit some of our sales tax revenue in a region where we have such, we have tourism issues, we have beach renourishment issues, we have environmental issues, and the sales tax money, we need that. And my constituents have been very vocal that they do not support any sort of sales tax redistribution.
How do you make the case to the other legislators, especially legislators from rural districts?
I think they understand it, that we're not going to support it, those of us who are in more urban areas, because of our population and the needs of our population, and are in some situations greater than the needs of their population. We've got more people. We have more issues that need to be addressed, you know, whether it be crime statistics, the opioid problem here in Wilmington. We need to be able to utilize our resources to combat these problems.
Senator Harper Peterson, this is the first time I've been able to say this to you face-to-face on the air. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Was this a surprise? And what's on your agenda as you head to, I mean, this is, you know, we're no longer in the campaign season. What's first for you?
It's a pleasant surprise. And the reason I ran was to win and to campaign aggressively and represent our community in Raleigh. So now the work begins, and it's work. I was listening to Ted Davis's comments. You stay busy. It's already busy. I feel like I'm a freshman in college learning from some experts across the board, not only other legislators on both sides of the aisle, but school of government, Chapel Hill, our legislative services, there's a lot, so I've got to really wake up my brain. It's been a while.
What has surprised you the most about the process after the election?
This is a busy state. We have lots of challenges. We have a lot of people that are on the challenges, a lot of solutions or suggested solutions. But I think at the end of the day, you have to work with other legislators, whether it's urban, rural, suburban, and find solutions for the state as a whole. as well as addressing solutions for your immediate district, your representation. So I'm anxious to work with Holly, to be perfectly honest. We're not going to agree on a lot. We'll find out as we move forward. But I think it's important. If I'm representing my constituents, and obviously some of my constituents are in Holly's district, House 20, then we need to be talking about it. We need to find common ground on important issues and try to, you know, come to some solutions that satisfy our constituents. That's at the heart of it. My next step up the ladder will be on the Senate Minority Caucus, Democratic Caucus, and working with the governor. But again, I'll always come back to, and you will remind me, you the public, that I represent you first.
And along those lines, if you heard the first part of this discussion with Representatives Butler and Davis, you heard listeners saying, is there any movement along a process for a nonpartisan redrawing of districts? Can we get away from gerrymandering? Please, please, please put the public good first. Think about the people. You know, there was this theme of wanting to get back to what it means to be a public servant and kind of getting away from the partisan political agendas. Representative Grange, are you hearing that from constituents?
I do hear that from constituents, but I also agree with what Representative Davis said, is that the party that is in, that is not in charge is always going to be the one that complains about the districts and how that those districts are drawn, and it's vice versa maybe the next time around if the other party is in charge. And I also think it's very difficult to say that anything can be nonpartisan in this day and age. I think that there's always going to be some sort of bias that someone has, and that would be displayed, maybe not even intentionally. But there, I don't think nonpartisan can work. I don't think it exists.
You, Senator Peterson, you also mentioned the busyness of all of this. How much is really involved? And Representative Davis, of course, has talked about that at length. Do you think that there will ever be a movement towards a full-time legislature? Right now, this is a part-time gig, in name anyway. But
no. In fact, I believe in term limits, and it shouldn't be. Fortunately, I'm available to dedicate the time. My wife is handling the business now, and she's happy to see me out of the house and on the highway going to Raleigh. But I think, you know, it's a volunteer service. You're serving your community. It's not a profession. We're not paid as a profession, so I think that's important. But I think term limits, I believe in that as it was originally designed.
You're listening to Coastline. The North Carolina General Assembly convenes next week, and today we're hearing from local legislators about their agendas for the coming session. With us right now, Senator Harper Peterson, Democrat in District 9, and Representative Holly Grange, Republican of District 20. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Penny writes, I realize lawmakers figured out HB2 was harmful enough to our state to water it down and sunset it. However, it still exists. And companies such as the film industry know it still exists. And she writes, it is still a detriment to our state. She says, I know Deb and Harper are opposed to it and would like to hear, she sent this in the last segment, Ted Davis joined them in vowing to rid us of this as immediately as possible. Please try to move our state forward, she says. But Representative Grange, what would you say to Penny on this front?
I think Penny is right. It's something that, you know, the sunset is coming up. We need to address this. HB2 was a solution in search of a problem. Many people have said that, and it has hurt our area. And the film industry is very important to Wilmington. My constituents have voiced that to me, and we do need to take care of this hanging over us.
And, of course, bringing back film to North Carolina, Kay wrote in and said, what's being done? That's certainly part of the city of Wilmington's legislative agenda. Senator Peterson, What's the strategy there?
I think the strategy is with a stroke of a pen, we could move up to sunset. and bring the industry back, not only movies but TV. It's changed in the last 5 years since we had no incentive, and then we introduced the grant program, which I think is a poor substitute, but again, that's for another discussion. But the fact is that we're losing an incredible amount of opportunity for jobs and obviously tax dollars. I think we were at 270 million in revenues in 2012-13. Last year, over $60 billion in Georgia alone, Atlanta principally, associated with entertainment, whether it's movies, TV, music, feature film. It's a new industry. It's changed, and we're losing weekly, it seems. Production companies looking at our area, but 142 gets in the way, and they want a clear message from the legislature. They've had it from the governor that we want to welcome film back with open arms. We created it 35 years ago. We own it, and we deserve to have it. And it's great for working men and women. And we have just turned upside down so many families that no longer have the luxury of having a job, being part of a community, a productive part of this community. So I'm 100% behind it. Obviously, we're in the minority, but hopefully we'll move this along quickly.
So you're talking about readjusting the structure of the incentive from a grant fund to the old tax rebate?
It's limiting. And why? I mean, if the grant program is an incentive, but why limit it? Why be so narrow if we are welcoming film back? Let's open it up and reinvent or update, reimagine what the incentive can be and help educate everybody. I think it's an educational process. So let's not hesitate because, again, we are losing production company after production company. You read about it in the papers. Thank goodness we have the Swamp Thing here, you know, just holding the line. But the sooner the better. And again, I understand now that Savannah has taken the lead. The head of L.A., and that's amazing. We were Hollywood East not 5 years ago.
Representative Grange, is the minority, will they gain any traction in a push for changing the structure of the film incentive?
It will be difficult. I have a lot of colleagues on my side of the aisle that do not understand the importance of the film industry to North Carolina and even to this region, and they are the ones that we have to win over in order to change the program. I've had colleagues brag to me about movies that have been filmed in their district, but then look at me and say, but I'm not going to vote for your film incentive in the next breath. So there is an education process that needs to go on.
And are you talking about, I mean, certainly you've expressed the fact that you're a supporter of the film industry and you want to bring more of it here, but are you talking about fattening what goes into the grant, or are you talking about possibly entertaining the idea?
I would entertain the idea of trying to restructure the system, but it has to be something that we can pass, and it has to get through the House. And actually, a lot of times it's harder to get things through the Senate than the North Carolina House of Representatives. So we have to be able to do that. I think that the governor would certainly sign anything that, you know, would have to do with that. But I think it's going to be a long process. We did what we could last biennium by getting rid of the sunset of the program and making it recurring money so that there was a little more predictability, and then tweaking it to allow different types of projects. But there's a lot of work to be done, and it has to be something that we can get through our chambers.
Jeff writes, why is the difficulty of getting a perfect nonpartisan redistricting commission an acceptable excuse for not trying to get a good nonpartisan redistricting commission?
I'm not saying that we're not trying to get a good nonpartisan redistricting commission.
It's interesting. You did say that you implied that you think most people think in partisan ways.
They do.
That they're either red or blue.
And you know how I know that? This last election cycle, I saw it every day out on the campaign trail. And I'm not saying that redistricting should be fair, but I'm telling you, if the Democrats were in charge now, I assure you that the Republicans would be complaining about the current districts because we have in the past.
That's true. Both parties have been guilty of gerrymandering. There, no question about it, which is why some states have moved to a nonpartisan process where they've set up independent panels, and there are a few different models for that. We've had academics and courts say North Carolina is a gerrymandered state.
I'm not sure that we're not going to look at those types of nonpartisan panels and employing those in our redistricting efforts. I'm not saying we're not going to do that. I'm just saying it's very difficult to say that anything is nonpartisan at this day and age.
Is there any value in trying to find common ground? And I'm reluctant to use the buzzwords of, you know, civil discourse and all of that, because I think it the more it gets used, the less meaning it carries, the less thoughtful people are about what that really means. But we keep hearing from listeners, we're hoping for something, a little more meaningful negotiating process or an outcome that really does engage all different kinds of affiliations. And it seems like our listeners anyway are just getting kind of tired of that hard divide.
It's frustrating, and I think we should strive to negotiate and work together because it's for the common good. I like to think of us as a delegation down from this part of the state, and we have unique issues that we need to deal with as a delegation. And those, to me, there are a lot of those that are nonpartisan. Things that we can cross, we can agree to disagree on certain things, but generally we want to do what's right for our community.
Andy writes, while the Chemours debacle has generated greater awareness about public trust in water quality, will the legislature expand its water concerns to include, for example, the discharged pollutants from the dozen-plus municipal wastewater treatment plants located upstream from where Wilmington draws its drinking water? Senator Peterson.
Yeah, I think everything is in play here. Point source pollution or discharge into our public waters, and in this case, our source for drinking water. I think we have to look at everything. It's a new day. Everybody I speak with in the community wants to know what's in the water. Is it safe to drink? Who puts these contaminants in the water? Are they going to be responsible and pay for the damages? Are they going to share with us all the information they have? Are they going to identify the chemicals they're discharging, whether it's in the air, water, or soil? They need to be responsible, and we shouldn't be paying for their mess and their mistakes. So I think that's my starting point. That's the community's starting point. And obviously the consent agenda that's being brought forward by DEQ and Riverwatch and Southern Environmental Law Center is a hot topic right now. I want to know what the next steps are. If this is the first good step, I want to know what's next, and I do want to know how we're protected and how our problems, our concerns, our issues, our challenges are addressed here in the Wilmington, southeastern North Carolina.
So you're supporting that consent order as it's written?
Well, here's my position right now, okay? It's still out there. It's a draft. The public comment period is just concluded. Speaking with Secretary Reagan yesterday, they're going to bring all of the information back, bundle it up by topic, and present it to the public and amend this consent order. That was a draft. I'm surprised that the county and the city have already voted on supporting or opposing it. It's not complete yet. So let's see what the completed project is, then have the discussion, and then come out for or against. But at the end of the day, it has to be additional steps taken. And there's individual lawsuits that I respect, whether it's Brunswick County or Cape Fear Public Utility or class action suits. All of these are welcome, and we need to preserve that emphasis. We don't want to diminish the impact that they'll have.
Representative Gray.
Well, and, you know, I look at it also from a statewide perspective. We're very focused on the Cape Fear River for obvious reasons down here, but there are issues all over the state. So we need to have processes in place so that everybody in North Carolina knows what's in their water and knows that their water is safe to drink.
We keep hearing the Hardison Amendment gets in the way of the state really creating some sort of regulatory framework that allows the agencies who are in charge to actually control drinking water quality. Is the Hardison Amendment an obstacle, and should that be done away with?
The Hardison Amendment will not apply in situations of public health and safety. As lawmakers, we are always obligated to act if public health and safety is at risk. The Hardison Amendment does not preclude us from taking care of those issues.
And so in this case, while EPA has been slow to establish a regulatory framework for compounds like Gen X, is it time for DEQ to set stricter standards?
DEQ can set stricter standards if it's in the interest of public health and safety. Now, the EPA is not, obviously, because the government is shut, federal government is shut down, they're not testing the water. But the law that the law that we passed last short session does provide that the collaboratory will take over that role in the event that the EPA cannot get results back to us in a timely manner.
As Ms. Grange mentioned, we need to know throughout the state what's in the water, if I'm hearing her correctly. We need to take an aggressive posture, and we need to develop regulations that address these issues. Who's putting what in the water, and what damage is it having on our health, on the health of our environment, our animals? And I think those are good questions. I take this very seriously, as I think everyone that's concerned about it, that lives here. So let's get aggressive about it. The Hardison Amendment is in the way. It needs to go away. There's no reason to have it. There's no reason to question whether this is an opportunity or an obstacle when we are concerned about the public health and safety. So it's antiquated. It needs to disappear.
Companies have to disclose what they discharge. There's a national discharge permit application process that they need to go through. So DEQ knows what every company discharges into the water. The problem is, frankly, that the system, DEQ, none of that is automated. If you go to DEQ to look at someone's discharge permit, you're going to be handed probably 2 or 3 feet height of binders. Another part of the law that we passed last session is so that there will be an automated database that you can access to determine what is in the water. So discharge permits require that every company list what they are discharging.
We also know there are bad players out there that don't follow the regulations.
Well, and then that's DEQ's job is to enforce those regulations. That's
and we see the
job.
Power that the private sector, the industrial sector, has in North Carolina. When the Clean Water Safety Act was introduced in May of the last
year.
You're
talking about the legislation sponsored by your predecessor,
right.
Senator Michael
right.
Lee.
And the North Carolina Manufacturers Alliance put their pen to it and asked for certain deletions, and they got them. And they wanted a narrow focus on just a certain class of contaminants, PFAS. But they didn't want to touch pharmaceuticals and other emerging, potentially damaging chemicals. So I think it needs to be wide open. I know people laugh at the West Coast and California, but they have what they call an environmental chemical lab. And it's a registry for everything that is discharged into the public waters and air. And they test everything, and they know. And that's a good goal to have, I think, for North Carolina.
That's one prong of,
right.
of the solution.
And a part of that is biomonitoring, medical monitoring. How is it impacting you and me?
I think that's the piece, that there's not enough research.
Really. And that's one concern about this consent order. It only identifies or focuses on 5 when we know there are hundreds and thousands of chemicals.
I want to get to Kate's comment from Wilmington. She called in and said, given other states are making strides in using unbiased third-party resources to draw more fair districts, why aren't we looking into this more? Will the new legislature take the initiative to look into this, or will they fall back on the old tired line of it will always be biased, so why try to change anything? It's interesting, the pushback that we're getting on this.
Yes, and I certainly think it should be looked at. We should look at other options and what is being done in other states. Why reinvent the wheel?
And quickly, one answer, will you oppose or support offshore drilling and seismic testing? Harper Peterson.
Oppose.
Holly Grange.
I don't think it's necessary.
That's this edition of Coastline. Representative Holly Grange, Senator Harper Peterson, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Holly.
Thanks also to Representatives Davis and Butler. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.